Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show with today's guest, Jesse Conklin, Senior Project Manager with Bond Brothers. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. Jesse's background has been exclusively in the utility space, and in particular, the building and planning of cogeneration plants for college campuses. Therefore, this episode is going to be a bit more, educational in nature, discussing what cogeneration, sometimes called combined heat and power, is, as well as the benefits such as resiliency, cost savings, and environmental impact. But before we get started, I'm going to express in my primitive way what cogeneration is and how I'd describe it. I would describe it as the burning of fuel to spin a turbine to create electricity, and then capturing that heat from burning the gas to produce steam or hot water to heat and or cool a building. Beyond that, there's a number of other ways that more energy is extracted from the process, but that certainly exceeds my pay grade and is why I have a guy like Jesse on the show. This is part one, where we cover the basics, and then we come back for part two, and I hope you come with us, when we go into a broader discussion about bigger subjects like environmental impact, renewables, uses for / setting up of district energy plants, breaking down the use case for viability of a particular cogen plant, all those type of things. It's going to be really exciting. But today is part one. We're going to cover the basics. So enjoy the show. Hey, Jesse. Welcome to Mass Construction Show.
How you doing, Joe?
So, Jesse, obviously I asked you to come in because personally and myself, I'm super interested in cogen, what I like to call cogen sometimes. Combined heat and power is the other phrase I hear. I imagine there's a lot of people out there that are wondering what it is. Seems super complicated when you first hear about it. And then I think as you learn, it is a little less complicated. But for folks that might not know what that is, what is what you would hear as cogen or combined heat and power?
Sure. Yeah. So cogeneration is generation of electricity and the recovery of heat to use in another application, whether it be a thermal load or a reused steam turbine to capture more additional electricity. So basically making sure you're getting most efficiency out of any process that you're running.
Okay. So how about just in its basic form, like not necessarily get into all the other recaptured ways, but like what does that look like in practice?
Yeah, so our basic form that we're seeing is a gas turbine, where gas is being burned through a gas turbine that generates electricity. That waste heat is exhausted through a heat recovery steam generator that produces steam. That steam is used for typically a thermal heating load, or it also can be also used for absorption chillers or steam turbines for additional electricity. That is what we're seeing.
Okay. Now, I'm going to drive you probably insane with the detailed questions, but someone who's, despite being in construction, I'm not like mechanically minded, you know, I can fix stuff and I can do things, but like just, you know, took me a while to figure out what a heat exchanger was, right? I had to read that about 17 times to figure out what was really happening. So I'm going to attempt to dumb it down a little bit.
Okay.
And you correct me where I'm wrong and... Yep. Please give me a color commentary. So a company, an institution, buys natural gas from the utility. They burn that gas, right? And the pressure coming off, like I heard somebody use an analogy, but it's like a jet engine, right?
Yep. And it is a jet engine. It's just packaged into interior enclosure.
Oh, interesting.
So there's two versions out there. They call them aeroderivatives, which means that the engine was originally created for the airline industry for airplanes.
Okay.
And they packaged them into for a gas turbine application, or the industrial engines that are strictly made for use in industrial. They aren't made to go on airplanes.
So, oh, wow. Yeah. So you legitimately could be buying a jet engine to do this.
So there's companies that specialize in the industrial side and some that do both. Like, for example, GE is a perfect example. They live in both worlds of airline industry as well as the gas turbine industry.
Okay. All right. So you're buying that gas. You run the engine, right? And instead of discharging all this air to shoot the jet up, right, you run that through a turbine that spins and creates electricity. So buy gas, produce electricity.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
But there's all the heat that's generated in that process.
Yep.
And you're, in this case, you're saying you're doing it with steam, but you're gonna, you then capture that heat. And now, can you capture it in multiple, is steam the only option, or could you heat up water with it? Could you?
Yeah, so the conventional, yeah, the, due to the temperatures of coming off the engine, which vary from, like, say, 700 to over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the typical application is steam coming off of it. On the smaller engines, on the other side, you do have the recip world, reciprocating engines that they strictly use for hot water generation, where the temperatures are lower on the exhaust gases. But on the gas turbine side, it's typically steam, but that steam can be converted to hot water through another process if needed.
Okay. So you use that heat, you heat up the water, creates a steam, and then the only time I've heard of steam being used is just steam heat, right? So, for example, let's say you're on a hospital campus or a college campus. You then have steam lines run throughout, and you're using that power to heat.
Steam distribution is one of like the oldest forms of thermal distribution, especially out here in the New England area, where the hospitals and colleges relied on that for over 100 years now, and that's distributed underground or through buildings, primarily for heat, but there's also absorption chillers that use the steam heat to produce chilled water as well. Is a pretty popular application.
So that was one that I read, and I didn't understand how that process works. So I understand the steam heat piece, but the absorption chiller, can you explain how that process works?
Yeah, on the absorption side, it's simply a matter of running a compressor on the chiller side, such that you're removing heat from one side of the process to the other. So on the chilled water side, you want to remove heat from the chilled water portion. Mm-hmm. And so the heat coming from the steam is used to drive that compressor that compresses that cycle to create the refrigerant cycle to remove the heat. So it doesn't really matter. Usually electric motors for that compressor, steam can be used as well.
Okay.
Because it's a good energy. That's just to drive a compressor.
All right. No, it makes sense. Yeah. Every you have a compressor when you get a central air in your house or whatever, you're just using that steam to
as an energy source.
As an energy source. So burn the fuel, create electricity, use the byproduct of heat to heat up the steam. Steam heats the dorms, the hospital rooms, what have you. The pressure from the steam helps you get chilled water through the evaporator. Are there any? I've seen a few other different ways you can still like continue to pull more energy out of it, or find other ways to.
Yep. So steam is towards the steam has also been converted to hot water. Hot water distribution has been the way the preferred way of heating buildings now, and anything in the last, say, 30, 40 years is use steam, hot water in lieu of steam. So trying to use that steam heat to generate hot water and use hot water distribution for either underground or at the building level for better control and more efficiency.
Okay. So that's the process that, for background, you've done how many of these so far, I want to say?
I started my career as a co-op at a cogen plant for UMass Amherst. And then for a better part of my career, I've actually been working at the MIT Central Utilities Plant through various projects throughout the years that are one side or the other of the cogeneration process. So it's been... for amount of jobs, difficult to quantify, but because I've been so many years at MIT, but feels
probably have 10 years in this.
I've been in the industry for 12 now, so okay. Pretty much my entire career
has been related to this. Okay, so a college campus chooses to go this route, and that's great. There's obvious benefits there, right? There's potential cost benefits, and we'll get into that a little bit down the line. For people who don't know, and you grab the average person off the street, they're just assuming a hospital or college is buying electricity, right?
Yep.
Prior to cogen, were institutions creating their own power to begin with?
Some were. It was more from probably a reliability standpoint and maybe a lack of support from the local utility years ago. It was more a byproduct of just efficiencies of well, if we can generate electricity and use the heat, but we really need the heat, number one, but let's generate electricity at the same time because it makes more sense from a financial aspect.
Okay. So they were doing it. It wasn't a cogen process. Maybe this
it was
a
maybe
little
the term
bit,
wasn't there.
Yep. And it was more of a matter of lack of capacity from the utility? Was it?
I would say it's probably more of, it just made more financial sense at the time when they were making those decisions.
So it was cheaper for them to make their own power than to buy it from a utility?
Potentially. And give them reliability they were looking for, yeah.
Yeah. Because you've got, presumably, college campus where you have bunch of students sleeping, or if you lost power, right?
Yes.
Or if you have a hospital and you lose power, that's a big problem, right?
Yep.
And this just, I think I've heard the phrase kind of like it gives you resiliency.
Resiliency is the buzzword right now in the industry, especially after, I'm trying to blank on the hurricane that hit New York City.
It was in New Jersey too. Was it Sandy? No.
Yes, Hurricane Sandy. Yes. So that's the big push, and that's, Hurricane Sandy alone, especially on the utility side, as well as on the college campuses or hospital campuses that are FM insured, have changed their standards from that one event. The biggest thing we've seen is elevated electrical substations.
Yeah.
You do not build substations and basements anymore after that.
Yeah.
And even Eversource and National Grid are pushing that amongst their end users. Is they're going
to
build a new substation in?
Get
it
up.
Elevated. That was just that one event really changed how
they're looking at everything. Okay. So historically, it's been a resiliency thing, just not wanting your. I mean, they weren't thinking in the storm manner, but just access to power.
Utility reliability. We'll see on that end.
And then how does that process work when. Because it's not that they're not buying any power from the grid. How does it work about what's being bought versus what's being generated, and what are some of the dynamics behind it?
Yeah, so every end user has a different interconnection agreement with utility depending on who the which state you're in and who utility is. But typically, these facilities strictly generate power for their own use and don't generate power that send back out to the grid, because that's not what the intended use is for. There's more regulations that change how you live in that world. So they want to stay as always importing a little bit of electricity from the utility, but generating 90-95% or whatever the loads are for that campus environment is what they try to achieve.
Okay. So they want to be close to 100%. They're buying some just to keep the utility happy, or like?
Well, you always need, utility always needs to be available, because especially on, it's difficult to, on campus environments to have enough equipment to provide 100% of your load, especially during an outage, whether it be a planned or unplanned outage on a major piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So you need that utility backup, and you want to make sure everything's. You need that utility there to be your partner to make sure when those events happen, you have the ability to have electricity for campus. And at the same time, the utilities see that as a way to offset maybe future load growth on their grids, meaning that instead of with all these new buildings being added in with certain areas, if a more generation locally is being made, there's less infrastructure needed to maintain their current system. So that's sort of a partnership that that exists out there.
Okay, that's interesting, because I would have thought they kind of reflexively would have been opposed to this because you're just not.
I was told before I got in this business that's the way it was. But now, with due to the age of the infrastructure out there and current growth, especially in the Boston market, is if a major campus was going to expand without any generation, it would put a significant strain on a utility.
Their infrastructure.
So this allows that partnership to exist so that, they can both manage it together.
Yeah. Now, if you're, if a campus system, let's say for, if I don't know if this is really a possibility, but if it went down completely, would that just tax the utility so much that, I mean, would they be able to respond and power an entire campus when they haven't been for?
I would typically, designs we come across, it's designed for that exact reason, is that utility can provide 100% of power. If not, there's options to allow some load shed schemes that allow to maintain so you don't overburden the current power. But usually you try to design for that, case, but it doesn't occur as often as you would like. And there's also, based on utility rate structure, there's impact to doing that. So if that end user had to do that for a certain period of time, it would be a financial maybe penalty to do that, but it was sometimes you have to do it for outage reasons, mechanical reasons. So
yeah. And do they ever go ahead and just test it?
Yes, some try to, if they can. That's something we try to, and we get involved in our projects early on, is have abilities to do that testing. The term out there is black start, basically your everything's, all the power's out, and you have to come up from black, so it's called black start. And some of the, there's ways out there to test that feature without actually doing it, through some controls and switchgear arrangements. So that's not like a new popular thing, because that's on some of the older installations, it's impossible to do, and it's also very important for these campuses to be able to test that, because when it does happen, if guys haven't been trained on it, it's difficult to execute.
Yeah, I mean, I would think I would feel a lot better if I knew that. I'd be more concerned, like, obviously, yes, the in-house training is great, but I'd be concerned with the utility's response.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Because I don't know what numbers they, or what units they operate in, if it's gigawatts or if it's some like terawatt or something like that. But I only can imagine that the utility company has a pretty good idea of the ebb and flow of the power demands.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden they're like, well, we just had 100 gigawatts of additional power requested, like
not that much, but
yeah, I don't, like I said, probably, yep, shows my naivete with this, but I imagine that surge of power.
If you want to go like that big, larger scale, there's the way that the grids operate, at least in New England, they use the independent service operator model. So the New England ISO, as it's called, manages all the generation throughout New England, and they actually have a website. You actually look out, and they predict loads for the entire grid for New England based off of temperature and season, and they make sure that they have the assets available to do so. And then they work, obviously the local utility companies are working with New England ISO to make sure that it all works seamlessly.
And can utilities get power from other utilities? Will they, or other?
Yeah, it's a complicated market for, they could probably hold the whole day on utility purchasing. probably not the best to speak to that one.
Okay,
because that's all right. That, on the utility side, that's a complicated world.
Okay.
But yes, there's
ways around that.
Yeah, the market for utility purchasing, whether it be fuels or electricity, is quite complicated. And there's firms out there that we work with to help navigate owners and how to make those decisions.
I looked down at my notes when you started to talk about selling power back to the grid.
Yep.
I remember hearing that early on when, you know, maybe 5-7 years ago when they were really kind of getting hot and heavy into solar panels on homes, and they were saying, oh, if you have excess, you can sell it back to the grid. Then, and this is just all things you hear out on the street now, and you say you can't sell it back anymore, you can't sell more. But like, what's the relationship with the utility if you do have excess? Can you sell back to the grid? Can you just put it back to the grid and not get paid for it? Like, how does that?
Yeah, you can. So like, it goes back down to what I think I said earlier was with the grid is operated by the company New England ISO, mm-hmm. and most of the clients that we work for are nonprofits, so they don't want to exist in a world where they're selling something because that's not what their core function is.
Yep.
And it sets regulations and tax and other things, so that the whole designs of these jobs just did not do that. So yeah, you can do that for a very little bit, but they're really not set up to do that.
Okay.
But I think I had a note here that I think is sort of important to that level is some of these projects that we work with and is a feature out there they call demand response. I'm not sure if you've heard that term yet.
I haven't,
but
no.
A lot of the major institutions in this area, since they are big chunk users of electricity, participate in programs through utilities they call demand response. So during the peak load season, during the summer months, most likely when everyone's running their ACs and the grid's pushed to the max, there's an incentive for these large users to actually reduce load and generate more electricity than they normally would. To help the cause, exactly. So if they can commit to, hey, I'm going to reduce what I'm taking from the grid and do more than I typically would, there's like a financial incentive. So and there's companies that navigate that that whole demand response world. That's sort of a big thing because it really is a low cost approach for large nonprofit institutions to be able to save on the utility rates.
Oh, that's great. And I think the added benefit is probably the relationship you're building with that utility,
yep.
Right?
Yeah, where there's a financial incentive, and the financial incentive is usually backed by a reason to help. It helps the utility, so that's what they're incentivizing.
Yeah, because even if you didn't necessarily even get paid for it, just the goodwill that you're helping them when they need it.
Yep.
You have a problem, things go down, and
yep.
you need their support, they're not going to be like, you know, we can swear in this thing. They're
yep.
not going to be like, fuck you. Like, you're only buying a,
yeah.
you know,
yep.
10% of the power you used to buy from us. I'm not
yep.
jumping for you. You know what I mean? We'll
yep.
get to you when we get to you. But now that, I think that just opens up a pretty positive
yep.
relationship. So there's the potential to put it back into the grid. Is there, like, I've heard of some folks on, like, the energy storage side, they almost do, like, an arbitrage, more or less, which is, you know, they'll actually go ahead and buy power at off-peak hours,
yep.
store it in batteries, use that on peak hours, and just, they're making up the delta on the energy because they're such heavy energy users.
Yep.
Is there anything that you've seen institutions or private companies or whatever do to look at when they're buying power, not necessarily doing that arbitrage per se where they're buying it and using it later or whatever, but is there anything where they're looking at timing, which is, okay, we want to be buying power in off-peak hours and running a little more when it's peak hours because it gets really expensive? Like, have you seen
any of that
type of stuff?
Yeah, so that's a trend we're seeing with energy storage. So I think
one of my favorite topics. So
yeah.
Okay, go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think specifically there's two areas where we see a big push in. Specifically right now is thermal energy storage with respect to chilled water storage, and that's two main reasons why that's works for these large institutions. One is the ability to generate chilled water on off-peak hours when electricity rates are less, so that they can generate chilled water at night. And store it so it's ready to go for the next day. At the same time, the thermal energy storage actually is a allows to increase capacity for chill water production on a major loop. In lieu of adding more chillers for that peak load, it allows that stored energy of chilled water to be dispersed during those peak hours of those peak summer days that only happen mm-hmm. only maybe 5-6 days a year.
Yeah, so you get like a stretch of 95 degrees.
Instead of putting millions of dollars into equipment that you're only going to need for a couple days a year, that storage tank allows that ability to meet those peak demands at the same time, allows them to operate more efficiently by buying electricity at a lower rate at night.
Okay, so help me out. You, and maybe it's me and everyone's gone, I fucking understand him. I don't know why he's rewording this, but you don't want to be burning that using that power during the day when the air condition is needed. It's the middle, it's noontime, it's scorching hot, everyone's turning on their ACs. Power is most expensive to buy at that point.
Yes.
Correct? So what you're doing is the night before, you're buying the power at night to create the chilled water, storing it in a giant holding tank.
Yeah, it's a giant water tank, no different than you've probably seen it for oil tanks.
Like on top of a hill or whatever, like you would see in
it's just a steel tank with headers in it that generate, because the tanks are large enough such that that the variation in temperature can be quite significant. So obviously the hotter water, warmer water is on top, the colder water is on bottom, so that the supply comes out the bottom and the return water comes out the top. So there's enough stored energy in that tank such that the use of that tank during the day, the variation of temperature is very little.
Okay. And is it just super insulated? Is it like a double line tank? And
is it insulated? It just the sheer volume of the amount of gallons of water. It takes so much takes so much energy to
cool that down,
or to heat it up or cool it down. Yeah. Just think of your bit largest pot you got, how long it takes to heat up. The same thing means to cool it down or heat up for the same thing with the summer load. So that it works, and it just all you need is a little bit of space to install these big tanks.
Okay. All right. So that's like a really way to store energy, yep. Right? And it's a way to access cheaper energy.
Yep.
Okay. Anything else you're seeing on
that front? I think the key, and maybe we should have spent a little time on it, is that it's actually one of the more affordable ways to add chill water capacity to your system at the least amount of capital costs.
So, like you mentioned, not buying the chillers.
Instead of adding chillers, it means you're adding cooling towers, adding pumps, adding square footage to your facility where the construction mm-hmm. costs are relatively high.
Yep.
The infrastructure to add these is minimal. So it actually is allows to add more capacity with the least amount of capital costs up front.
And that's because if you need on-demand chilled water, you would need a lot of horses in the barn, per se, to say like, okay, give me it all. Yep. You need a lot of them there to produce it. Whereas if you can just run them less, but just run them more yep. constantly, you know, yep. or the night before, then you can, and then yep. store that. That's where you...
Yeah, and it really comes down to it's that capacity, because the, I like to say is that these large institutions are continually to add square footage with these new buildings with donor names on them, but not many donors want to put their name on the chill water plant or the power plant. It's just not as flashy. So
the Jesse Conklin air handler, AHU2.
So,
yeah.
This is a way for those institutions to, meet the demands of these new buildings that are continually to be built with, the budget constraints that people have to spend towards utilities, which sometimes those institutions, it's hard to fight for those dollars. So it's a good way to add that capacity.
Okay. What are some of the other benefits, you would say, outside of the straight potential costs? We're going to dive deeper into costs and yep. how this all really kind of plays out. But is there anything else where it's kind of like added benefits with like efficiency or less maintenance? Or there's obviously, you read a lot about like environmental impact. Like what's maybe some of the other reasons to kind of think about going the cogen route if you're gonna
Yeah, so I think so. It comes down to the number one is efficiencies. So for every BTU of energy you're going to be putting into a process, the cogeneration is getting the most return on that. So I think it's a key thing to make sure you're getting every bit of energy out of that fuel that you're using, because that you just get, instead of wasting it to the atmosphere, whether it be greenhouse gas emissions or global warming or those sort of trends, the cogeneration key is actually meaning that you're using more of that energy to get the most out of it.
Okay, yeah, can we dive into that a little bit? So I've read numbers anywhere from 30% to 50% in traditional power generation actually of the energy gets used. Right, so you have a typical power plant. Yep. They burn coal, gas, whatever. 30% of that creates electricity. 70% of the energy goes into the air or into the water, however they...
Yeah, I think that those are probably your older numbers from your simple cycle. Like I said before, just wasting the heat coming out of the gas turbine.
Yep.
Right to the atmosphere. That I should look at my numbers before this, but I think you're at the efficiency level. So that cogeneration gets you almost twice as much as that, because you're capturing that waste heat. And then, like I said, we talked about steam too. The next big push is hot water. So typically, when you steam is 225 degrees Fahrenheit and above, if you will, for above boiling water temperature. So hot water exists at that low level. So in the HRSGs, you need to keep the hot gases hot enough so such that you can exhaust up and don't have condensing in the back ends of the boilers for various reasons, most likely for cleaning and keeping the boiler tubes clean over time. But the production of hot water now is a new trend at the end of this cycle, because there's uses for that now. So you can drive your exhaust gas temperatures even lower, capture that much more energy and have it used for it. So instead of exhausting out, say, 300 degrees out the stack, you can drive it down to the 200s and take that much more energy and use it somewhere else.
And it's some type of like a plate exchanger or something where the heat transfers into the water?
A cogeneration HRSG example, it's a series of tubes, just tubes that are headed together. So the exhaust gases pass right through it. So it's air to,
passing through the water.
air to metal exchange. So
okay. So yeah, and that is the term where they'll say like waste, right? So like you're producing energy in the form of heat. If that just goes out into the atmosphere, out the flue or the exhaust, that's considered wasted, right? And the more you're squeezing out of that by producing steam, heating hot water, electricity, yep, all these things, is just, you're just extracting more and more out of there. And I think a good thing for people to maybe hear, and because everybody learns differently, I mean, I can't tell you how many times they say, oh yeah, this boiler's 92% efficient,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Well, what does that even mean? Yeah, I'm so like, all right, like,
same,
I don't, like
it, so it's the same run, as your residential home boiler. So those super high efficiency boilers, they kind of use that same application, but they're actually getting that much energy out of it. I mean, yeah, the exhaust gases is cooler, and that's, yep, why they're designed totally differently. So when you get the gas down that low, there's some condensing issues. That's why the boilers are using more money, because you have to upgrade all the metals and materials within those units. But mm-hmm, it's the same exact function that on the utility, on the larger scale, you look at those numbers. You got to find that point where it works great, so that you're using that much energy as possible without having to have too much added equipment at the end.
Yeah. So equipment equals cost. Right, and even if you're talking about, we're talking about a residential boiler, and you're psyched because I'm at 95% efficiency.
Yeah.
That means only 5% of that energy that got wasted out, you know,
yep,
flue or wherever. So that efficiency number goes up and up, and there's a like a break. I don't know if a break even point is right, but even think about the home boiler, and you were saying the parts get more and more expensive.
Yes.
So it's great that you're getting it super efficient and you're driving your heating costs down, but if the unit costs $75,000 to buy, then it's probably not worth it, right?
Right.
I imagine that institutions are doing the same type of analysis when they're deciding whether this is a good decision.
For us, that's really where we start almost. Is when we're brought into projects or clients, partnering with engineering firms, is navigating that financial aspect of trying to find, I guess I'll call it the sweet spot, where you can look at what the loads are, what the budgets are, and try to find a way such that you could satisfy the equipment selection to meet the budgets that have been established, as well as maybe look at return on investments. If there's efficiencies to be gained by a capital investment, that can pay itself back in a term that the institution's willing to invest in. The better you can make that look on paper, the better off you get that project moving forward.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. First thing I want to say is, as of late, I've been getting a lot of people resharing the podcast, video clips, things like that. And I can't thank you all enough, the folks that are doing it, likes, shares, and retweets, things like that. Really matters. It helps keep me motivated. I love doing this. It sounds like you guys love listening to it. So I really appreciate all those things. Any 5-star ratings, those are awesome too. Reviews are awesome. So just thanks, everybody. Hope to see you guys back next weekend to listen to the second half of what Jesse has to say. Take care.